On the morning of the second day, a Russian delegate was given the floor. Ellie's computer screen identified him as Stefan Alexeevich Baruda, Director, Institute for Peace Studies, Russian Academy of Sciences. She heard Michael Kitz say to Elmo Honeycutt of the State Department, "Now we start to play hardball." Baruda was a dapper man, wearing an elegantly tailored Western business suit. His English was fluent and almost unaccented. "Let us be frank. A message is being sent to us from the far reaches of space. Most of the information has been gathered by Russia and the United States. Essential pieces have also been obtained by other countries. All of those countries are represented at this conference. Any one nation could have waited until the message repeated itself several times, as we all hope it will, and filled in the many missing pieces. But it would take years, perhaps decades, and we are a little impatient, so we have all shared the data. Any one nation could place into orbit around the Earth large radio telescopes with sensitive receivers. Then that nation, by itself, could acquire all the data. But that might be thought a hostile act, so perhaps for this reason, too, we have all shared the data. It is better to cooperate. Our scientists wish to exchange not only the data they have gathered, but also their speculations, their guesses, their dreams. All you scientists are alike in that respect. I am not a scientist. My specialty is government. So I know that nations are also alike. Every nation is cautious. Every nation is suspicious. None of us would give an advantage to a potential adversary if we could prevent it. And so there have been two opinions. Perhaps more, but at least two. One that counsels exchange of all the data, and another that counsels each nation to seek advantage over the others. The scientists have won this debate. Most of the data have been exchanged worldwide, and we are happy we have made this decision. Ellie whispered to Kitz, "This doesn't sound like hardball to me." A grim smile. "Stay tuned," Baruda continued. "But there are other kinds of dangers. We would like now to raise one of them for the consortium to consider. We've heard that we are receiving the instructions for building a complex machine. Now, the beings on Vega, they are not sending us these instructions for their amusement. They want us to build a machine. Now, perhaps they will tell us what the machine is supposed to do. Perhaps not. But even if they do, why should we believe them? So I raise my own fantasy, my own dream, and it is not a happy one. What if this machine is a Trojan horse? We build the machine at great expense, turn it on, and suddenly an invading army pours out of it. Or we build it, turn it on, and the Earth blows up. Perhaps this is their way to suppress civilizations just emerging into the cosmos. It would not cost much, they pay only for a telegram, and the upstart civilization obediently destroys itself. What I am about to ask is only a suggestion, a talking point. I raise it for your consideration. I mean it to be constructive. On this issue, we all share the same planet. We all have the same interests. No doubt I will put it too bluntly. Would it be better to burn the data and destroy the radio telescopes?" A commotion ensued. Many delegations asked simultaneously to be recognized, but the order of speakers had already been established. Devi Sukhavati would speak next, then Ellie, then one of the Chinese delegates. Ellie knew Devi Sukhavati slightly. She was a stately woman in her mid-40s, wearing an exquisite silk sari. Originally trained as a physician, she had become one of the leading India experts in molecular biology, and now shared her time between King's College, Cambridge, and the Tata Institute in Bombay. She was one of a handful of Indian fellows of the Royal Society of London. Sukhavati rose and began speaking. "It would be foolish to dismiss the Trojan horse possibility carelessly. Given most of recent history, this is a natural idea, and I'm surprised it took so long to be raised. However, I would like to caution against such fears. It is unlikely in the extreme that the beings on the planet of the star Vega are exactly at our level of technological advance. The extraterrestrials are likely to be far ahead of us, perhaps thousands of years ahead, or even millions. We can pose no threat to them whatever. They have nothing to fear from us, and that will be true for a very, very long time. If they wish to destroy us, they can certainly do so. Perhaps there is a danger in building the machine. I think there is a danger in not building the machine. I would be ashamed of our planet if we turned our back on the future." Sukhavati sat down to applause, and Ellie rose to speak.
"Mr. Chairman,
I believe we can shed some light on these two questions, the Trojan horse and the doomsday machine. I had intended to discuss this tomorrow morning, but it certainly seems relevant now. On her console, she punched in the code numbers for a few of her slides. We think, though we can't be sure, that this is what the interior of the machine will look like. There is as yet no clear indication of scale, but notice these five objects evenly spaced around the periphery of the main interior chamber inside the dodecahedron. Here's a close-up of one of them. This appears to be an ordinary, overstuffed armchair, perfectly configured for a human being. It's very unlikely that extraterrestrial beings evolved on another quite different world would share our preferences in living room furniture. So it's our contention, Dr. Lunacharsky and I, that the five chairs are meant for us, for people. That would mean that the interior chamber of the machine is only a few meters across, and the exterior perhaps 10 or 20 meters across. The technology is undoubtedly formidable, but we don't think that we're talking about building something the size of a city, or as complex as an aircraft carrier. We might very well be able to build this, whatever it is, if we all work together. What I'm trying to say is that you don't put chairs inside a bomb. Now, I don't think this is a doomsday machine or a Trojan horse. A United Kingdom delegate stood up and shouted at her. The speaker simply doesn't understand what our concern is. If it was literally a wooden horse, we would not be tempted to bring the alien device within the city gates. We have read our Homer, but flounced up with some upholstery and our suspicions are allayed. Why? Because we are being flattered or bribed. There's an historic adventure implied. There's the promise of new technologies. There's a hint of acceptance by, how to put it, greater beings. But I say no matter what lofty fantasies the radio astronomers may entertain, if there is even a tiny chance the machine is a means of destruction, it should not be built. The meeting became unruly. Scores of delegates were electronically queuing for authorization to speak. The hubbub rose to a subdued roar. The Chinese delegate, archaeologist Shi Chu Mu, rose to speak. He was a tall, broad-shouldered man around 60. The wrinkles on his face made him seem older, but his posture and physique gave him an almost youthful appearance. If we are frightened, we will do nothing. That will delay them a little. But remember, they know we are here. Our television arrives at their planet. Have you looked at our television programs? They will not forget us. If we do nothing, and if they are worried about us, they will come to us, machine or no machine. We cannot hide from them. If you are seriously frightened about this machine destroying the Earth, do not build it on the Earth. Build it somewhere else. Then if it is a doomsday machine and blows up a world, it will not be our world. But this will be very expensive. Probably too expensive. Or if we are not so frightened, build it in some isolated desert. If we are not frightened at all, we can build it in Washington, or Moscow, or Beijing, or in this beautiful city. In ancient China, Vega and two nearby stars were called Shi Nu. It means the young woman with the spinning wheel. It is an auspicious symbol, a machine to make new clothes for the people of Earth. We have received an invitation. Maybe it is to go to a banquet. It would be impolite to refuse. Derheer, Kitts, and Honeycutt had called a meeting at the American Embassy early the following morning to prepare for the arrival of the Secretary of State later that day. The meeting was to be classified and held in the embassy's black room, a chamber electromagnetically decoupled from the outside world, making even sophisticated electronic surveillance impossible. Or so it was claimed. Ellie thought there might be instrumentation developed that could make an end run around these precautions. She had tried unsuccessfully to reach Derheer. She was getting irritated. First the man turns up everywhere in the Argus facility, he moves in with you, you're sure for the first time in years you're in love, and the next minute you can't even get him to answer the phone. She decided to attend the meeting, if only to see Ken face to face. Kitts was enthusiastically for building the machine. Drumlin, cautiously in favor. Derheer and Honeycutt at least outwardly uncommitted. And Peter Valerian in an agony of indecision. Kitts and Drumlin were even talking about where to build the thing. Freightage costs alone made manufacture or even assembly on the far side of the moon prohibitively expensive, as Dr. Shi had guessed. Derheer seemed impatient, distracted. He was clearly under great pressure, alternately avoiding her eyes and, she thought, making some unspoken appeal. She took it as a hopeful sign. Drumlin was saying, "If you want to worry about doomsday machines, you have to worry about energy supplies. If it doesn't have access to an enormous amount of energy, it can't be a doomsday machine. So as long as the instructions don't ask for a gigawatt nuclear reactor, I don't think we have to worry." Ellie spoke to Kitz and Drumlin. "Why are you guys in such a hurry to commit to construction?" Kitz looked from Honeycutt to Dahir before answering. "This is a classified meeting. Now, we all know you won't pass anything said here on to your Russian friends. It's like this. We don't know what the machine will do, but it's clear, from Dave Drumlin's analysis, that there's new technology in it, probably new industries. Now, constructing the machine is bound to have economic value. I mean, think of what we'd learn. And it might have military value. At least that's what the Russians are thinking. See, the Russians are in a box. Here's a whole new era of technology they're going to have to keep up with. They'll have to bust their economy trying. And if all this message stuff went away, then the Russians could maintain military parity. That's why they're so cautious. So of course that's why we're gung-ho for it." He smiled and moved on to the composition of the crew. "They're asking us to put people in 5 upholstered chairs. Which people? Now, a major question is going to be who pays for what, who builds what, who's in charge of overall systems integration. I think we can do some real horse trading on this in exchange for significant American representation in the crew." Dahir noted a little obviously, "But we still want to send the best possible people." Kitz nodded. "Sure, but what do we mean by best? Scientists? People with military intelligence backgrounds, physical strength and endurance, patriotism? That's not a dirty word, you know." And then he looked at Ellie. "There's the question of sex. Sexes, I mean. Do we send only men? Are all the crew members going to work together okay? If we go ahead with this project, there's going to be a lot of tough negotiation." Ellie said, "This doesn't sound right to me. This isn't some ambassadorship to buy with a campaign contribution. This is serious business. Also, do you want some muscle-bound moron up there, you know, some kid in his 20s who knows nothing about how the world works, just how to run a respectable 100-yard dash and how to obey orders? Or some political hack? I mean, that can't be what this trip is about." Kit smiled. "No, you're right. I think we'll find people who satisfy all our criteria." Dahir, looking almost haggard, adjourned the meeting. He managed to give Ellie a small private smile, but that was all. Ellie and Vege had lunch again at a window table at the Chez Dieu. Merely meeting with her alone entailed certain risks for Vege, and for her as well, as Kitz had gone out of his way to remind her. Vege had in fact been shocked by Bruder's question about burning the data and destroying the radio telescopes. He had had no advance knowledge of Bruder's position. His own opinion was that the Russians had played a vital role in gathering the message, and they would expect a major role in whatever came next. Ellie assured him that, as far as she was concerned, they should have such a role. But she was not sure that she would be playing any part in decisions on machine construction or crew selection. She was returning to the United States the next day, mainly to get on top of the new radio data from the past few weeks. The consortium plenary sessions seemed interminable, and no closing date had been set. Vege had been asked to stay on a little longer. "Ellie, I'm worried all this will end badly. There are so many things that can go wrong. Technological failures, political failures, human failures. And even if we get through all that, if we don't have a war because of the machine, if we build it correctly and without blowing ourselves up, I'm still worried." "About what?" "The best that can happen is we will be made fools of." "Wait, who will?" "Attaway, don't you understand? I'm amazed you don't see it. The Earth is a ghetto. All human beings are trapped here. And now along comes an invitation. We are to send 5 villagers to, who knows, Warsaw, or Moscow, or maybe even Paris. And what do you think will happen when they get there? They will laugh at us behind their hands. They will exhibit us to the curious. The more backward we are, the better they'll feel. The more reassured they'll be. It's a quota system. Every few centuries, 5 of us get to spend a weekend on Vega. Have pity on the provincials, and make sure they know who their betters are." Ellie pored over the studies that had accumulated during her absence. There had been almost no progress in decrypting the message, although the statistical analyses now stacked into a pile of paper a meter tall. It was all very discouraging. She wished there was someone, especially a close woman friend at Argus to whom she could pour out her hurt and anger at Ken's behavior. But there was not. She realized that being the president's science advisor, trying to manage the most amazing discovery in the history of the world, put incredible pressure on him. But still. After returning from Paris, Derhier had mustered a regular campaign of apology and devotion. He had been overstressed, he told her, overwhelmed with a range of responsibilities, including difficult and unfamiliar political issues. His position as leader of the American delegation and co-chairman of the plenary might have been rendered less effective if there had been public knowledge of his and Ellie's relationship. Kitz had been insufferable. Ken had too many consecutive nights with only a few hours sleep. Altogether, Ellie judged, there were too many explanations. But she permitted the relationship to continue. Vega had been low in the sky an hour or so before dawn when the computer triggered an understated alarm. With some annoyance, Willie put down his book, took a look at the computer screen, and picked up the direct line to Ellie's apartment. The message had cycled back. Racing across the screens was a paired sequence of zeros and ones, a real-time comparison of the data just being received and the data from an early page of text received a year before. The program would have called out any differences, but so far, there were none. It reassured them that they had not mistranscribed, that there were no apparent transmission errors. The message repeated exactly. The gaps were all filled in, and nobody could read a word of it. It seemed unlikely that the transmitting civilization, meticulous in all else, had simply overlooked the need for a primer. At least the Olympics broadcast and the interior design of the machine seemed to be tailored specifically for humans. So humans must have overlooked something. It soon became generally agreed that somewhere was a fourth layer to the palimpsest. But where? The president sneezed and tried to find a clean paper tissue in the bulging pocket of the terrycloth presidential bathrobe, while Ken Derhier stood waiting.
"My doctor tells me I have to stay in bed or I'll get pneumonia. If you're not afraid of my germs, pull up a chair."
"Viruses. Thank you, Miss President. This is about the primer. Briefly, we're reading and actually understanding the thing with almost no difficulty. It's a fiendishly clever learning program." The president shook her head. "I don't understand how it's possible. I can see how they could teach you the names of their numbers, or of some objects, but I don't see how you could do verbs of the past tense or conditionals."
"They do some of it with movies. Movies are perfect for verbs, and a lot of it they do with numbers. Numbers first, then simple equations to teach plus and equals, then symbols to indicate true and false. Then they teach division. Divide one by zero and tell us the word for infinity. Or maybe it's just the word for indeterminate." When the message recycled and we discovered the primer wasn't there, we started thinking of other possibilities. It turned out to be phase modulation or phase coding. The primer is scattered throughout the message. Lots of repetitions. We must have a vocabulary of 3,000 words by now. All this work has been done in close cooperation with the Russians and everybody else. I don't think there's any unilateral course of action for us."
"I don't want a unilateral course of action for us. I just want to make sure that nobody else has a unilateral course of action.
So back to your primer. You know how to say plus and equals and true and false, but how do you build a machine with that?"
"Well, it just takes off from there. For example, they draw us a periodic table of the elements. So they get to name all the chemical elements, the idea of an atom, the idea of a nucleus, protons, neutrons, electrons. Then they run through some quantum mechanics just to make sure we're paying attention. There are already some new insights for us in the remedial stuff. Then it starts concentrating on the particular materials needed for the construction. For example, for some reason we need 2 tons of erbium, so they run through a nifty technique to extract it from ordinary rocks. Don't ask why we need it. Nobody has the faintest idea."
"I wasn't going to ask that. I want to know how they told you how much a ton is."
"They counted it out for us in Planck masses. A Planck mass is..."
Never mind. It's something that physicists all over the universe know about, right? And I've never heard of it. Now, the bottom line. Will we be able to build the thing or not?"
"The answer seems to be yes. We've only had the primer for a few weeks now, but whole chapters of the message are falling into our lap in clear. It has a painstaking design, redundant explanations, and as far as we can tell, tremendous redundancy in the machine design. We should have a three-dimensional model of the machine for you in time for that crew selection meeting on Thursday, if you feel up to it. So far, we haven't a clue as to what the machine does or how it works. And there are some funny organic chemical components that don't make any sense as part of a machine. But almost everybody seems to think we can build the thing. Who doesn't? Well, the Russians, and some of the nuts, of course. There are still people who worry that the machine will blow up the world or tip the Earth's axis or something. But what's impressed most of the scientists is how careful the instructions are, and how many different ways they go about trying to explain the same thing. And what does Eleanor Arroway say? She says, if they want to do us in, they'll be here in 25 years or so, and there's nothing we could do in 25 years to protect ourselves. They're too far ahead of us. So she says, build it. And if you're worried about environmental hazards, build it in a remote place. Professor Drumlin says you can build it in downtown Pasadena for all he cares. All right, Kent. I'll read all the briefing material in time for that Thursday meeting. The treaty they're hammering out in Paris gives us about a one-quarter say on who builds the machine. The Russians also have a one-quarter say, the Chinese and the Japanese together have a quarter, and the rest of the world has a quarter, roughly speaking. A lot of nations want to build a machine, or at least parts of it. They're thinking about prestige and new industries, new knowledge. As long as no one gets a jump on us, that all sounds fine to me. Europe and Japan surrendered crew representation in exchange for extensive responsibility for the construction of machine components, which they believed would be of major economic benefit. In the end, after a long and difficult multilateral negotiation, seats were reserved for the United States, Russia, China, and India, with the fifth seat undecided. In the four selected nations, scientists, national leaders, and others were going through the exercise of choosing their candidates. Nominees in the United States included religious leaders, sports heroes, astronauts, Congressional Medal of Honor winners, scientists, movie actors, a former presidential spouse, television talk show hosts and news anchors, members of Congress, millionaires with political ambitions, foundation executives, singers of country and western and rock and roll music, university presidents, and the current Miss America. The president and her science advisor were in the Oval Office discussing the crew selection. All right, Ken. There's no official decision to be made today and no public announcement of our deliberations, but let's see if we can sum it up. We don't know what the goddamn machine will do, but it's a reasonable guess that it goes to Vega. Nobody has the slightest idea of how it would work or even how long it would take. If this machine is a kind of a spaceship, it will take 26 years to get there, but only as we measure time here on Earth. Is that right? Yes, exactly. Plus maybe a year to get up to light speed and a year to decelerate into the Vega system. But from the standpoint of the crew members, it would take a lot less time, maybe only a couple of years, depending on how close to light speed they travel. So as long as the machine goes very close to the speed of light, it might not matter much how old the crew members are. But if it takes 10 or 20 years or more, and you say that's possible, then we ought to have somebody young. Now, the Russians aren't buying this argument. We understand it's between Arkhangelsky and Lunacharsky, both in their 60s. The Chinese are almost certainly sending Shi Chu Mu. He's also in his 60s. So if I thought they knew what they're doing, I'd be tempted to say, what the hell, let's send a 60-year-old man. David Drumlin, Derhier knew, was exactly 60 years old, the president continued. On the other hand, the Indian doctor, she's in her 40s. In a way, this is the stupidest thing I've ever heard of. We're picking somebody to enter the Olympics, and we don't know what the events are. I don't know why we're talking about sending scientists. Mahatma Gandhi, that's who we should send, or Jesus Christ. Derhier smiled. When you don't know what the events are, you send a decathlon champion. And then you discover the event is chess, or oratory, or sculpture. Okay, you say that it ought to be someone who's thought about extraterrestrial life and who's been intimately involved with the receipt and decryption of the message. That narrows our list down to David Drumlin and Eleanor Arroway, since Peter Valerian doesn't want to go. Arroway's some 20 years younger, but Drumlin's in terrific physical shape. He hang glides, skydives, scuba dives, he's a brilliant scientist, he helped in a big way to crack the message, and he'll have a fine time arguing with all the other old men. He didn't work on nuclear weapons, did he? I don't want to send anybody who worked on nuclear weapons. Now Arroway's also a brilliant scientist. She's led this whole Argus project, and she'd convey a younger American image. She paused.
but sometimes she's a loose cannon. Did you listen carefully to her questionnaire? Here, it's supposed to be all queued up on the VCR.
I think I know the passage you're talking about, Miss President, but the selection committee had been asking her questions for almost 8 hours, and sometimes she gets annoyed at what she considers stupidity. Drumlin's the same way.
Derheer pushed the play button. On the television screen, Ellie looked terribly tired, and Derheer felt a pang of guilt.
What do I think of the world population crisis? You mean, am I for it or against it? You think this is a key question I'm going to be asked on Vega, and you want to make sure I get the right answer?
Okay, overpopulation is why I'm in favor of homosexuality in a celibate clergy. A celibate clergy is an especially good idea because it tends to suppress any hereditary propensity toward fanaticism.
The president pushed the pause button.
We want the developing world on our side in this project, Ken. We had a good reason to ask a question like that. Don't you find her answer shows some lack of tact? She's a bit of a wise-ass, your Dr. Arroway.
Miss President, she's intelligent, she's tough, and she's very professional. The range of her knowledge is broad. She's just the person we need in this situation.
Ken, more than half the people I talk to believe we've got no business building this thing. If there's no turning back, they want to send somebody absolutely safe.
Arroway may be all the things you say, but safe she is not.
Drumlin's going to be much more acceptable than Arroway. I recognize Drumlin's something of a cold fish, but he's reliable, patriotic, sound. He has impeccable scientific credentials, and he wants to go.
No, it has to be Drumlin. The best I can offer is to have her as backup.
Oh, cheer up, Ken. Don't you want her to stay here on Earth?
It took years. It was a technological dream and a diplomatic nightmare, but finally they got around to building the machine. Various neologisms were proposed and project names evocative of ancient myths, but from the beginning, everyone had called it simply the machine, and that became its official designation. When the first reliable estimate of the total cost was generated, even the titans of the aerospace industry gasped. Eventually, it came to $500 billion a year for some years, roughly a third of the total military budget of the planet. There were fears that building the machine would ruin the world economy, but others saw the machine as a potential bonanza. Some of those who worried about the safety of the planet swallowed their scruples when contemplating the implications for jobs, profits, and career advancement. President Lasker pronounced herself confident that American technology would rise to the challenge and implied, although she did not actually say, that American ingenuity would eventually equal anything they had on Vega. She was reelected by a respectable but by no means overwhelming margin. Both in the primer on language and basic technology and in the message on the construction of the machine, nothing was left unclear. Sometimes, intermediate steps that seemed entirely obvious were spelled out in tedious detail. At every stage of construction, there were checkpoints. If any of the tests failed, you went back and redid the whole business. After a while, you got used to the tests, and you expected to be able to pass them. Many of the underlying components, constructed by special factories designed from scratch by following the instructions, defied human understanding. It was hard to see why they should work, but they did. Even in such cases, practical applications of the new technologies could be contemplated. Promising insights seemed to be available in fields like metallurgy or organic semiconductors. In some cases, several alternative technologies were supplied to produce an equivalent component. The extraterrestrials could not be sure, apparently, which approach would be easiest for the technology of the Earth. For the construction of one component, a particularly intricate set of organic chemical reactions was specified, and the resulting product was introduced into a swimming pool-sized mixture of formaldehyde and aqueous ammonia. The mass grew, differentiated, specialized, and then just sat there. It had an intricately branched network of fine hollow tubes through which perhaps some fluid was to circulate. It was colloidal, pulpy, dark red. It did not make copies of itself, but it was sufficiently biological to scare a great many people. They repeated the procedure and produced something apparently identical. These huge, delicate blobs were to go inside the main structure, a dodecahedron just above and below the crew area. Identical machines were under construction in the United States and Russia, and a component testing facility was established in Japan. In each country, a remote site was chosen, not so much to protect population centers as to control access by protesters and the media. Where components could be manufactured with something like existing industry, manufacturing was widely dispersed. An optical subcontractor in Germany, for example, would make and test components to go to the American and Russian machines, and to Japan, where every component was systematically examined to understand how it worked, so far as was possible. All the early subsystems were based on elementary technologies described in the first part of the message. The prescribed tests had been passed readily enough. As the later, more complex subsystems were tested, occasional failures were noted. Since no one knew how the components worked, it was usually impossible to trace backwards from failure mode to identification of the flawed step in the manufacturing process. In some cases, the components were made in parallel by two different manufacturers. If there were two components, both of which had passed tests, there was a tendency for each nation to select the domestic product. Thus, the machines that were being assembled in the two countries were not absolutely identical. Finally, in Wyoming, the day came to begin systems integration, the assembling of the separate components into a construction process. Completion within a year or two seemed likely. The facility in Wyoming was not much different from Argus, Ellie found. Both were surrounded by tens of thousands of square kilometers of lovely, almost uninhabited landscape. She wasn't running the show, and she wasn't one of the crew, but she was here, working on one of the grandest enterprises ever contemplated. Surely, no matter what happened after the machine was activated, the Argus discovery would be judged a turning point in human history. She felt a glow of almost maternal pride. Yes, she had cried when she heard that she had not been selected. There was, of course, a part of her that longed to be aboard. But Drumlin was a first-rate choice. He seemed to have mellowed in the past few years. Being chosen by the President of the United States to represent the nation to the extraterrestrials was a great honor. The trip, he said, would be the crowning point of his life. No decision had been made by the Russians between Lunacharsky and Arkhangelsky. Both would train for the mission, though it was hard to see what training might be appropriate beyond understanding the machine as best they or anyone else could. Both men were extremely capable. Ellie wondered how the Russians would decide which to send. Ellie Arroway, David Drumlin, and Peter Valerian went through the usual identification sequence involving credentials, thumbprint and voice print, and were then admitted to the vast assembly bay. The geometric design of the machine was simple. The details were extremely complex. The five chairs in which the crew would sit were amidships in the dodecahedron. There were no facilities for eating or sleeping or other bodily functions, clear evidence that the trip, if there was one, would be short. Some thought this meant that the machine, when activated, would quickly rendezvous with an interstellar space vehicle in the vicinity of the Earth, though meticulous radar and optical searches could find no trace of such a ship. It seemed scarcely likely that the extraterrestrials had overlooked elementary human physiological needs. Maybe the machine didn't go anywhere. Maybe it did something to the crew. There were no instruments in the crew area, nothing to steer with, not even an ignition key, just the five chairs. Above and below the crew area, in the tapering parts of the dodecahedron, were the organics, with their intricate and puzzling architecture. Placed throughout the organic matrix, apparently at random, were the huge dowels of erbium, and surrounding the dodecahedron were three concentric spherical shells, arranged with axes perpendicular to each other and designed to spin at high velocities. They were apparently magnetically suspended. At least, the instructions included a powerful magnetic field generator, and the space between the spherical shells and the dodecahedron was to be a high vacuum. The message did not name any machine component. Erbium was identified as the atom with 68 protons and 99 neutrons. The various parts of the machine were described numerically, component 31, for example. So the rotating concentric spherical shells were named Benzels by a Czech technician who knew something of the history of technology. Gustav Benzel had in 1870 invented the merry-go-round. While the Russians had some problems, the U.S. subsystems had finally passed all tests, and the overall architecture of the machine was gradually emerging. Three-story overhead cranes were positioning erbium dowels. Pentagonal panes for the exterior of the dodecahedron were hanging from an elevated railroad track. It's all coming together, Ellie thought.
The floor and the circumferential tracks at various altitudes in the assembly building were crowded with technicians, government officials, and representatives of the World Machine Consortium. The positioning of the dowels was almost completed, and the first major systems integration test was about to be attempted. Just as the test was to begin, they walked around a stanchion to get a better view. Suddenly, Drumlin was in the air, flying. Everything else seemed to be flying, too. As in a slow-motion film, Drumlin careened toward her, arms outstretched, and knocked her roughly to the ground. It was never determined who did it. The length of the list of organizations publicly claiming responsibility, from the Earth Firsters to the newly resuscitated Symbionese Liberation Front, was merely an index of how widespread opposition to the machine had become. As reconstructed by the Commission of Inquiry, one of the huge erbium dowels was sundered by an explosion. The two fragments careened downward from a height of 20 meters and were also propelled laterally with considerable velocity. A weight-bearing interior wall was struck and collapsed under the impact. 11 people were killed and 48 injured. A number of major machine components were destroyed, and many apparently unaffected components could also have been ruined. The president was incensed. "No crackpot group, however well organized, will deflect humanity from this historic goal." In practice, though, it was now much more difficult to achieve a national consensus. The sabotage had given new life to every objection, reasonable and unreasonable, that had earlier been raised. Only the prospect of the Russians completing their machine kept the project going. As nearly as Ellie could tell, Drumlin had died saving her life. He had seen the explosion before the others heard it, had spied the several hundred kilogram mass of erbium arching towards them. With his quick reflexes, he had leaped to push her back behind the stanchion. She was absolutely sure. Drumlin's concern was to save her life, and he had. Except for a few scratches, Ellie was physically unhurt. Valerian, who had been entirely protected by the stanchion, had had both legs broken by a collapsing wall. She had not even been knocked unconscious. Her first thought, as soon as she had understood what had happened, was not for her old teacher, David Drumlin, crushed horribly before her eyes. Not amazement at the prospect of Drumlin giving up his life for hers. Not the setback to the entire machine project. No, clear as a bell, her thought had been, "I can go. They'll have to send me. There's nobody else. I get to go." She caught herself in an instant, but it was too late. She was aghast at the contemptible egotism she had revealed to herself, even momentarily in this moment of crisis.